I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Steve Mould.
I'm Matt Parker.
I'm Helen Arney, and this is another episode of A Podcast of Unnecessary Detail.
If you're here for the podcast, that's great. If you're here for the detail, even better.
This episode is all about hearts and minds. We'll be searching for the place where logical thought and raw emotion meet. And if you're Matt Parker, that's basically the same place.
That's right. In this episode, I'll be doing some loving by numbers.
I've got some equations to make you go, ooh.
And my section is a complete embarrassment. I'm talking about blushing. It's about blushing.
Let's switch our hearts and minds to detail mode. Steve, are you doing hearts or minds today?
Well, I'm doing the interaction between the two. Specifically, I want to talk about blushing. It turns out blushing is really interesting, like not just from a physiological point of view, like how does it work, but also what's the psychology of it? In fact, like what's the evolution of it? So you might know like the physiology of it. When you blush, it's a co-opting of a system that already exists to regulate temperature. So you might know you've got these blood vessels, these tiny blood vessels all throughout your body, including in your skin. And each one of those blood vessels has a little muscle as well. And that muscle can contract or relax. So if you're cold, then your body sends a signal to these tiny muscles that contract your blood vessels or the blood vessels in your skin so that blood doesn't flow as much to your skin and you don't lose as much heat to the environment. So it helps to keep you warm. The opposite is true if you're hot, that those tiny little muscles relax and so blood is able to flow more freely to the skin and so you lose heat to the environment. It helps you to cool down.
Steve, so this is something you can see, right? You can see an effect on your skin.
Well, yeah. So for me, I'm quite a pale person. You'll be able to see it quite easily with me. Like if you saw that I was really sort of pale and ashen, you might assume that I'm cold. I mean, I am most of the time.
That's your default
yeah.
look.
Yeah. So, but if for some crazy...
I mean, you're the only one of us that we can see on the video call who's wearing several coats, from what I can tell.
It's true. Yeah. That's more because it's very hard to heat my studio. But who am I kidding? It's very rare that I'm warm. But when I am, you can tell by looking at my face. What's interesting, though, is the way these tiny muscles are controlled is different to the way your large muscles are controlled. So like your bicep, for example. Like I'm not saying I've got large biceps. I'm just saying that they're bigger than the tiny muscles that control my blood vessels. But I mean, marginally. But like, so the way your bicep is controlled, for example, is by nerves. So, you know, your brain sends a signal via nerves to your bicep and it contracts and you lift your arm or whatever. But the way these tiny muscles that control your blood vessels work, it's not by nerves, it's by chemical signaling.
Are they only tiny because you skip blood vessel day? Like, can you develop these muscles? Can you get better at blushing?
Yeah, I wonder.
Hang on, if you really worked them, you'd be better at contracting them, so you'd be better at not blushing. You'd be better at going pale rather than red, in Steve's case.
I take it back. Steve's always pale.
I'm constantly clenched on the smallest level. I mean, I guess you could work on those muscles. Like if you repeatedly went from a hot to cold environment, you'd be constantly tensing those muscles. I don't know. But given that it was a facetious question, let's move on. If you're cold, your body will send a specific chemical around your body through the blood, and these tiny muscles have receptors specifically for that molecule. And so, you know, the molecule lands on the receptor, and that's the signal that tells the tiny muscles to contract. What's interesting, and this is an oversimplification, but the tiny muscles in your face have an extra receptor for a different molecule. What that means is your body can contract and dilate the vessels in your face independently of the rest of your body. And that's where the ability to blush comes from.
So there's one dedicated molecule, like colderine.
Colderine, yeah.
Which you only release when you're cold. Yeah. And that tells your skin to bring all the blood in. It's getting cold out there. But you've also got blusherine.
I mean, I thought I was oversimplifying, but yeah, okay.
Okay, well, you know, I'm just...
No, it is more complicated than that, but that's a good overview of the prevailing view at the moment. Oh, and by the way, it's not just the face, like... For some people, it would include the neck as well and the ears. Here's what's interesting about blushing. You blush when you are embarrassed or ashamed or you feel regret about something. And it's important to communicate those feelings to the people around you. You know, we're social creatures, and it's important to conform to the social norms of the people that we are around. Otherwise, we might end up as an outcast. And, you know, certainly for our ancestors, being an outcast was a really bad thing. You know, it reduced your likelihood of passing on your genes and so on. So it's important that we're able to communicate that we know that we have messed up. We know that we have crossed some line. We have disregarded some social norm within the group. And of course, we can communicate that. Like, for example, if I was to go to a friend's house and I was looking at the pictures on the wall and I'm saying, oh, that's nice, that's nice. Oh, I don't like that one, though. I'm not sure about the colors on that one. And then my friend said, oh, I painted that one.
This is very specific.
It is very specific, isn't it? And I don't want to talk about it anymore. But... And so in that situation, it's important for me to communicate that I'm sorry that I made that mistake. And so I could just say, I'm really sorry. I feel embarrassed. I feel ashamed.
I feel embarrassed by how bad you are at painting.
Yeah, just double down on it. That's the solution.
Yeah.
But if I wanted to communicate those things, I could just say it. But the issue is, maybe I don't really feel it. Maybe I don't really feel regret. Maybe I'm just saying it because I know that's the thing that I'm supposed to say in this situation. And so what blushing does is it's a mechanism that we know can't be controlled. We know that blushing is out of our control. So when we see someone blush, we know it's genuine. We know that they are genuinely embarrassed about the thing that they just did. And so that's an important signal. And what's interesting is, you know, when you feel embarrassed, when you blush, it's horrible. It feels horrible in the moment. Blushing is this really unpleasant thing that we try to avoid. And that strengthens the power of the message as well. It's like you see someone blush and you're like, well, they're really uncomfortable at the moment, but they're blushing anyway. So I know that they feel embarrassed. I know that they know that they have broken one of the rules of the group. And I also know that they're very unlikely to do it again because of how unpleasant that feeling was. And so it's an example of something we do that is bad for us in the moment, something that's really unpleasant, but it is good for us in the long run because it helps with the cohesion of the group. It helps us to remain part of the social group and not become an outcast.
So this is like two sides of the same coin, where one side is you're an idiot, and the other side is you're a good member of the group. So
exactly right. Yeah.
It feels like to be able to kind of vouch for you, the blushing is like this is a cost to the individual to blush. And that kind of backs up that, you know, I'm legitimately embarrassed. Yeah. It feels a bit like mating displays, where if an individual in a species is just like, you got to believe me, I've got resources to spare, no one's going to believe them, right? But if you got some ridiculous plumage or something, you're like, no, this is a waste of resources, right? That actually vouches for the surplus. Yeah. And it feels like it's like the negative version of that. Yeah. Do you know if very good actors can fake blushing?
Do you know if politicians can stop themselves blushing?
Yeah, I read some articles about, you know, how to stop yourself blushing. And they were all psychological tricks, you know. There didn't seem to be anything sort of physiological that you could do to prevent yourself blushing. There were all ways of kind of almost disassociating from the current situation. But it's interesting, like, you know, we would all rather not have to blush. But in the long run, it's actually better for us if we do blush. And interestingly, it happens more amongst young adults, which is perhaps because that's when you're forming new relationships. It's also when you're inexperienced socially, and so you're more likely to make mistakes.
Our producer, Lindsay, has asked an additional question. We are all for more detail. So she said that she gets a thing where certain drinks make parts of her face go red, and it's not blushing, it's a reaction to what she's drinking. Steve, is that anything to do with blushing, or is that a totally separate deal?
Yeah, I mean, alcohol is often described as a dirty drug because it does so many different things in your body. It interacts with so many receptors. So, you know, it reduces your inhibitions, it makes you feel dizzy, it makes you slur your words. It does a lot of things. It also vasodilates as well. You know, sometimes people say if you're cold, you know, have a shot of whiskey or something like that because it'll make you feel warmer. And it will, but it's absolutely something you should not do, because what it does is it vasodilates, and so your skin feels warm because your blood is able to reach the surface of your skin because alcohol has that effect. But that's really dangerous. You know, the reason you feel cold and the reason you're vasoconstricting is because you need to. So if you're out in the cold and you think, I'm freezing here, take a shot of whiskey. It's actually going to make you cool down quicker, even though you'll feel warmer for that brief moment. So it's a terrible idea. And I guess it has a similar effect on the receptors for some people in the face.
So alcohol is a kind of anti-colder drink.
He's still going along those lines.
I have to carry on with your stupid naming system, yes.
Don't make me blush, Steve. I'm quite glad Steve has already blurred the lines between hearts and minds, because I thought I would do pretty much the same thing. Mathematically, I've come up with the most romantic number. And I say I've come up with, I'm just bringing it to present to you. It's been known since antiquity, and it's 220. So if you want a number which is going to stimulate the heart as much as the mind, 220 is your winner.
Right. So the main question is...
I assume there'll be no follow-on questions, so I don't understand.
So is that the number of dates you need to go on with someone before you...
Oh, that's good. That's a generous number of dates.
That's,
I mean,
quite
there's the whole optimal stopping theory about how many dates you should go on, and there are ways to calculate that if you want to be very precise about how you strategize your partner finding mission.
So is it,
and maybe
so,
you shouldn't
so
call
two,
it that. Working title.
Is it 220 dates with one person or one date with 220 different people?
Oh,
that would
I think
be
that
my
would
theory.
Be one date with 220
oh,
people.
Oh,
yeah.
Interesting.
Okay.
Yeah. I find that whole thing a bit off anyway, because within the details of it, you have to know how many people you're likely to date in your life. Or something like that. You need to know in advance, don't you?
Well, I take it you'd get an upper bound. You'd think, what's the maximum number of people before I just call it quits? And I'm like, forget this. I'm out.
The settling number, they call it.
The settling number. Yeah, yeah. You're like, frankly, it's just not worth it. Statistically, it's like a capture and release estimation. You're like, I just don't think it's... The odds are not in my favor.
Or, you know, to find your soulmate, let fate take its course. That's the solution, isn't it?
And what? And to meet my soulmate, I almost let eight take its course because I met my wife, Lucy. Thank you. Good segue. Because we were both working on the same course at a university, and she heard a rumor that there was another person working on the course whose watch told the time in binary. involving a Powerade. And that was the first she ever knew about me, was someone else working there had a watch that's all the time in binary. She's like, I want to meet that person. And it was this guy.
She was like, so I'm never going to get to 220. I'm going to stop now.
Exactly. She's like, that, done. That's it.
So hang on. This, so this 220 number, this isn't anything about like the physical process of dating.
Nah, it's nothing about the strategy for dating. It's nothing to do with, you've got 200, and, you know, it takes 220 muscles to contract a blood vessel or something like that, right? It's
it takes 220 muscles to say I do, or to like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It takes 220 muscles to smile politely while Matt's talking about the number 220. And 220, no, this is the mind part of the hearts and minds. So if you look at the number 220, you can tell very quickly it's not a prime number, as in it's got numbers that divide into it, because for a start, it's even. It's an even number. So you know it's going to be divisible by 2. It's also, well, it's obviously divisible by 1. Let's just get that out of the way. That's technically a factor.
I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say it's divisible by 10.
Yes. Oh, easy, nice move. And that will give you 22 for free. Because it's going to be 22 times 10. So that gives you 2 factors.
It gives you 5 and 2 as well. Oh, it gives you 5.
Also gives you 5. Yeah. Well, you could take that 5 and then you have to move the 2 over to 22. So it'd be 5 times 44. There's some more factors. I didn't know this would be a game, but I like where we're going with this.
11.
You also 11. Very nice. And what would that be 11 by?
20.
20. We have a winner. There's nothing more fun than spot mental arithmetic challenges. but you can you get the sense, actually, there's a lot of factors in the number 220. And they are, for completeness, 1, 2, 4, 5, as we covered, 10, 11, 20, 22, 44, we would have got there in a second, 55, and of course 110, which is half of 220. And of course 220 itself.
That's a nice host of factors. It feels like a lot.
Nice. Yeah. It's got a certain pleasingness to it, which is hard to articulate why I think that they're in a nice pattern. However, they are provably a nice set of factors, because if you add them all together, including 1, but excluding 220, we're not going to include the number itself as its own factor. I mean, 1's pushing it. We're not going to allow the actual number. If you add all those numbers together, you get 284, which is a bit of an anticlimax. However, 284, if you add all the numbers that go into 284, you get 220. And so these are a pair of numbers where if you add all the factors of one of them, you get the other number.
They do the same thing to each other. The factors of one add up to the other one.
First of all,
what?
1, 2, 4, 71, 142.
Thank you. I'm very relieved now.
Secondly, yes. So each of them, if you add all their factors, you get the other number. And so it's kind of like each number is intimately related to the other number, or linked somehow. Officially, they're called an amicable pair, which I feel like undersells the closeness of their relationship, just calling them amicable. And they've actually been, since antiquity, 220 and 284 have been a symbol of either romance or very good friendship. Very early on, when people realized they had this compatible property, they then used that as like a representation or an analogy or a manifestation of a relationship between two humans, which I think is amazing. And I've been very impressed with Steve's either good feigning of not knowing this or forgetting that we sell on Maskia. .co.uk a set of split heart keyrings where
is
one's
that
got
what those are.
That's what I still don't know which category you're in. He's not blushing either, so he's not embarrassed. So but he's put on another coat. So we sell a split heart set of keyrings. One's got 220 on it, one's got 284. And I actually had one on my keyring for a very long time. And it got so kind of worn that I eventually retired it. It was looking pretty... I mean, obviously, they're very high quality, and we recommend all the products on...
Very durable.
Yeah.
This begs the question, who had the other one, Matt? And did they retire your love?
Okay, first of all, Lucy had it. And secondly, she retired it sooner. So these are some of our early prototypes. We made them just out of quite cheap plywood. But I liked it because it was like the prototype when we were coming up with the idea. And so I they're the ones I kept, and they did not last. I also retired the binary watch. I was like, well, that's done. It's job. And it's now. I mean,
and it was a total pain in the ass to use on a daily basis.
It was. You know what? 30 minutes, half an hour is not off the power 32. And so the number of ones is not a bad way of splitting half hour, quarter hour, and so on. Mm. And you just, the more you see, the closer you are to 60. And so I thought it was great. I wore it because I was a teacher. And whenever students are like, what time is it? And I'm like, well, it's 1101 past 1010. And let's get back to work. So I miss teaching sometimes. Yeah, but they're not the only set of numbers that do that. So you can pick a bigger pair. And some of the mathematical greats throughout the ages have done exactly that. So in 1636, Fermat, of Last Theorem fame, actually bothered to finish this one. They found the pair 17,296, which pairs up with 18,416, which is quite nice. Wow. And Descartes, 2 years later, Descartes found, obviously having to outdo Fermat, 9,363,584. You add the factors of that together, you get 9,437,056, and then vice versa. And so they get pretty big pretty fast. But
are there ones smaller than that?
Yes and no. Great question. So there is none smaller than 220,284. That's as low as you're going to get. They are famously the smallest one. We have known about those since the ancient Greeks. Everyone else missed the next two.
What?
So the second smallest pair of 1,184 and 1,210, no one spotted that until a 16-year-old student found it in 1866. So I love it. It's one of the great examples of someone, like a non-professional mathematician, this is like a 16-year-old student, who then discovered something that everyone else had been overlooking for literally millennia. And they'd found loads of bigger ones, and they just missed this little pair, just hanging out there.
So the search algorithm isn't exhaustive, I guess.
No. And so Fermat and Descartes were coming up with techniques to kind of locate them, but none of them are perfect. Because when I'm listing the factors, I'm doing every single factor. But actually, all those factors, once we realized it was 22... and 10, we're like, well, actually, we can move the 5 around and we got the 2. It's all just the number of ways you can arrange the prime factors. And so there is a logic to them. However, adding factors puts... I'm going to use the word random here, but I don't mean that in quite the strict sense. It provides a certain amount of unpredictableness. Once you start combining, adding, and effectively multiplication, you get some unusual results coming out the other end, which keeps them quite... hard to pin down, difficult to locate.
I love that it was a 16-year-old who was like, I've got this beautiful number. Who am I going to give it to? I don't know. I just feel like whoever they gave it to, the likelihood of that relationship lasting was very small.
It's a famously bad age to discover a mathematical pair of numbers. You haven't got the life experience to know how to deal with it yet.
I bet he blushed a lot looking for the right person. And there weren't binary watches back then, so it was very hard to just distinguish who might be.
They were just like, I've got a sundial that just does it in ones and zeros. Will you honestly be my girlfriend?
If I had been born a couple centuries earlier, I have no idea. I don't think I would have panned out, I'll be honest. I think I was born as early as possible for the concept of me to work.
I do not disagree with that.
Thank you, Ellen. Now, the flip side of this is the number 276. Because we might be wondering, well, if 220 and all these other numbers, if they give you these fantastic pairs, what do all the other numbers do? Like, if we get a different number. Actually, does anyone want to suggest a number? I'll put it in. I'm not going to lie. I cobbled together some code in the 20 minutes before we started this recording. If anyone would like to offer a number, I will tell you how lucky it is in love and friendship.
624.
Is that just an arbitrary number, or is that...
Yes.
Good work. Okay.
No, it's my PIN number.
600, but where does the zero go? 624, which Steve has now given us with no personal meaning. If you add together all the factors of 624, of which there are quite a few, my goodness. 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, 8, 12, 13, 16, 24. Look at them all. There's loads. They add to give you 1,112.
Whoa.
Which the digits, if you add together all of its factors, proper factors, you get 988. And that gives you 972. And that gives you 1,576. There's a lot of numbers joining in here, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
That gives you 874, 566, and so on, so on, so on. If you carry that on, after 18 steps, you hit 1. Because after 17 steps, you hit a prime. You hit 43.
Oh.
No factors, okay. Just 1. And so you go to 1.
Yeah.
So any prime number slams you straight into 1. And if you pick a non-prime, like you very nicely did, Steve, if at any point in that process you hit a prime, game over. That's like the I give up point in the romantic search for that number. it turns out after 18 attempts, it's like, forget it.
Can I guess and try and beat maps?
Oh, yeah.
Like chain of events.
So Steve made it 18 steps. Okay, here we go.
Thank you.
I mean, I should pick something that I know has loads of factors. I immediately thought of 999. And then I thought, oh, no, it should be, like, more difficult. That seems so obvious. Like, that's got some factors. Okay, but obviously...
It's also that you go straight into a prime. 999 factors add to 521. Prime, two steps.
I said that's one I wasn't going to choose.
I'm glad you were... Yeah. Nice loophole. Right. What's the next one you're not necessarily going to choose?
Okay. Well, I was thinking about 1,000.
Get off the fence, Helen.
1,024.
Oh, power 2. Look at this.
That's two to the power of like whatever.
Nice. You got 7 steps.
How is that less?
Well, it just depends what you land on next. Well, you chose a power 2. So if you add together all of its factors, that's basically every power of 2 smaller than it, which gives you 1 less than that power of 2. So actually the next number is 1,023. And then that now you're off and racing. That gives you 513, 287, 49, 8, 7, 1.
Ah, and I've given away my PIN number.
Yeah.
All right. What about the number you mentioned? You mentioned a number and then you said nothing about it. What was it? 276?
276. Yeah. That's the worst case scenario. I'm going to keep avoiding for a little bit longer because there's one other good case. So the number Steve picked hit a prime. The number Helen picked a prime. Most of the time, you pick a number, it hits a prime. The other out that doesn't end in tiers like 276 is if it hits a loop.
Ooh.
So there are some numbers where instead of being a pair, you have numbers with... Well, actually, there's the trivial loop. There's numbers like 28 and 496, where if you add together all their factors, you get themselves. So they're
self-love.
Technically in a loop of 1.
Aww.
You know, they're self-sufficient. And then, and that's my final comment on that analogy. And then you've got numbers that get into a bigger loop. So there's a loop of 5 numbers, the smallest value of which is 12,496. So if you add together its factors, you get another number. Add their factors, you get another number. Eventually, you come back after 5. And there are loops that are 4 numbers long, 6, 8, 9. And there's one big one discovered, which is 28 numbers in a row.
Wow.
Where each one gives you another number when it doesn't repeat until 28 later.
This is for polyamorous relationships.
Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
I do not want to see the Google Calendar for that scenario. That's going to be messy.
It'll be a scheduling nightmare. Yeah. What people are working on is 276, which is, I don't know if open relationship is quite the analogy here, but we don't know what happens to 276. So you add together its factors, you get another number. You add together its factors, you get another number. And the numbers get big. Because each number doesn't have to be bigger than the previous one. But for 276, they race off. And we've followed it for hundreds of terms. And the numbers now have hundreds of digits. And it gets too big to compute. And so we don't know.
That's wild.
No one knows.
Hasn't settled.
But it keeps going. It doesn't give up. So we have no idea if that sequence of numbers will eventually hit a prime or hit a perfect number or hit a loop or hit something that will cause it to stop, or if it will go on forever. Open question. We have no idea in mathematics. And 276 That's is just really the smallest cool. example of a number that does that. There are other numbers which are the beginning of these chains, which as far as we can see, disappear into unimaginably large numbers, too big for us to follow and find out what happens. You can apply your own romance-based analogy to that scenario.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm going to move on from talking about mathematical love gifts to a mathematical love song, with a side order of unnecessary detail. We should probably just start by playing the song. Lindsay, could you do the honours?
Baby, I've looked at this empirically, and I think you're the one for me. Plus or minus three, and you're my man, and I want you to understand how it feels when I hold your hand. So I'll draw a Venn diagram. Statistically, I love you, and mathematically, I need you, and graphically, I want you, and on average, I'm gonna make you mine. Well, you're beautiful, and my love for you is irrational, and it's constant, it's recurring, and it's infinite, and you can use it to calculate the circumference of the circle of any known diameter. Maybe that's not love, maybe I'm just thinking of pi. Statistically, I love you. If you were a logarithm, I'd be your exponential. When you grasp my arithmetic, I find it very sensible. Give me your raw data and I'll show you my conclusion. Give me a new equation and I'll name a biscuit after you, like Choco Leibniz or Fig Newton or Petit Fourier. I know it's technically a cake, but
or Thomas Hobbes' knob, or Pythagoras' cream. Statistically, I love you. Therefore, logically, I need you. And rhetorically, do I want you? And theoretically, you are already mine.
That's really nice.
Oh, thank you.
What I love is often you write comedy songs, but that is just a nice, straight, down the line, true to experience romantic song, which I like. It's grounded.
By the way, I have got better at endings of songs since I wrote that. And I've also got better at fact-checking. So either of you, I know we've done this song on stage a whole bunch of times. I actually changed one of the words when we do it on stage. So you may not have picked up the error. Anyone?
It was jarring, both because it's different to what I'm used to from us doing it live, and it's wrong.
Yeah.
I think it's when you...
I didn't notice it.
Well, I know why, Steve. Because you really tune out if for any discussion of pie, you just stop paying attention. I'm pretty sure you described pie as recurring.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was a mistake. And when I recorded it some time ago, I've just left it in as a kind of Easter egg to see if anyone's really listening. And
That's a good spin.
Turns out, Steve wasn't, so that's fine. When we do this song live, I do sing constant non-recurring instead of recurring, because obviously otherwise Matt wouldn't find it as romantic, because it would be incorrect.
Can't you just record yourself singing non? Just sneak it into the edit.
Just dub it in.
Just sneak it in. I'm sure that's something Lindsay can do.
Yeah.
But with Matt saying it, with Matt's voice saying it.
And it's constant, it's non. Recurring, and it's infinite.
Seamless. No one's even going to notice.
Oh my God. Right. So when we used to do this song live, and I used to get the words right, we had Matt doing it on an overhead projector and Steve doing like a competing PowerPoint version of this song. And what was I really loved about this version that we do live is that we have a whole bunch of equations that are undisputably beautiful and trigger off emotional responses. There's the point where I sing, "You're the one for me," and Matt on the overhead projector, he writes minus E to the power of I pi, which is a version of Euler's identity, and then says that's equal to one. So like, "You're the minus E to the I pi for me." You know, that beautiful, essential, transcendental equation of Euler's. Like, it triggers off an emotional response in people. That's true for me. I don't know if that's true for you.
Oh, 100%. Yep.
Well, I obviously prefer E to the I tau. Then you don't need the minus sign. It's just a bit cleaner, isn't it?
We're not starting this now.
So it isn't just me and you, Matt, and to some extent Steve, who thinks that these equations are beautiful. Someone reminded me the other day of a study that was done by UCL Imperial College and the Mathematics Department of Edinburgh University, where they showed a bunch of mathematicians different equations, 60 different equations of varying complexity and significance. And they showed them to them while they were in an MRI scanner. So they were scanning their brains while they were showing them a whole bunch of different equations and asked them whether they thought the equations were beautiful or neutral or ugly. And what's so interesting about this experiment is the equations that mathematicians thought were beautiful triggered off the same patterns in the brain as if they were looking at a beautiful piece of art or an incredible piece of music or something that's more traditionally seen of as an aesthetically beautiful emotional event. So like, mathematicians,
that's amazing,
do think that these equations are as beautiful as something that is traditionally seen as beautiful.
What I love about that study is in the write-up, they had to point out that the study was approved by the Ethics Committee of UCL.
Yeah,
I don't know why. Like, because they had a control group. Maybe it was to show the control group the maths equations, or was it to show the mathematicians art? I don't know.
Well, yeah, I was...
What was the more unethical?
This is a really interesting study, and they've gone out of their way to make sure that they are only checking for whether equations are beautiful. They're not checking for other things. So they also did a survey afterwards to find out how well each mathematician understood each equation. So it wasn't like in the MRI scanner, they saw an equation and it wasn't, I understand that they were detecting. It was, that's right. Beautiful. So they because of all the control measures they put in place, by getting all of the equations ranked beforehand by beautifulness and then asking afterwards for how much everyone understood them, they're controlling to make sure that it is the beauty that they're reacting to, not the understanding. And this, to me, I find so interesting from a professional point of view, because the thing I try to do with songs that I'm writing, and I'm writing a musical at the moment, I'm trying to operate on a whole load of different levels. I'm trying to operate on the level of being clever, right? It's someone goes, oh, that's very clever what you've said there or what you've written. Oh, musically, that's a very clever thing. And you're also trying to do something funny, but you're also trying to do something beautiful. Mm. And I feel intuitively that these different things, like, hit different parts of your brain. You get like something that's beautiful and that goes like pow over there. Something that's clever, you can get your different part of your brain to go like, oh, pow over there. And something funny or something, you know, all of these different things. And if you get it right, you just get a cascade of brain explosion if it works. And this study for me kind of gives me hope that that is not a false assumption that I'm working on, that actually it's worth trying to get things that are clever and funny and beautiful all at the same time. And whether I manage to achieve it or not is a different question. But yeah. I wanted to check with you both about whether some of the equations that they tested are equations that you find beautiful as well. And we'll put them in the show notes so you can decide for yourselves at home as you're listening. Right, so highly rated equations. The equation that was rated most beautiful was Euler's identity. So classic. An average rating of nearly 9 out of 10. Oh, it's a good one.
Nothing causes your brain to release methadrine like Euler's equation.
We're still doing that. All right.
Does that make
we're still doing that.
Blood vessels dilate.
Oh, it does.
There's...
But what... What's particularly beautiful about something like that is just the amount of connections it makes at once. And so, yeah, that the sense of wonder when you behold that is, yeah, amazing.
There's one that got an average rating of -7, thereabouts. Most consistently rated as ugly was Ramanujan's infinite series for 1/π.
What?
Yeah. Ah. It's pretty wild. It's got loads of different numbers that don't seem to have a huge amount of meaning, like 2√2/9801, and then there's a sum, and then there's a whole bunch of numbers. I can hear Matt Googling it in the background.
Yeah, it's not...
Oh, look at it. It's so good.
You can't obviously see patterns in it, and it's numbers are very big, and there's no, you know, simplicity and elegance are valued, aren't they? And once you start throwing these big numbers that don't seem to have much structure to them, it loses some of that, maybe.
This is interesting when Helen was talking about the blurred lines between understanding and beauty, because I think what I find beautiful is the discovery. Like, you look at that and you're like, oh my goodness, that links pi to the square root of 2 to an infinite sum to factorials to all these things. And I'm like, and how is that discovered? Like, almost the bigness of the numbers, I'm like, what a rare gem that is. Of all the numbers and equations, this one was discovered where all the bits just fit together, and that unexpected result. What I'm trying to say is people were wrong when they were gave this a -7.
What we're trying to say is you have a more highly attuned aesthetic sense when it comes to equations, which may be as much nature as nurture. We will never know. What I'm trying to say is that the song we heard on its own does one thing, but when you perform that song in front of a crowd of people with a visual overhead projector and a PowerPoint competing behind you, showing some of the most beautiful equations that have ever been formulated, I feel like that is reaching some kind of optimum level of beauty and funny and clever. And I just want to do it again, right? I miss it. And
That's why all songs should have backing notes.
It sounds to me like what you're saying is people need to go and buy the DVD.
It's not on any of our DVDs. Steve, it's not on.
That's the most shameless plug since massgear.co.uk was mentioned.
It's not on any of them, Steve. I don't know if you...
Is it not?
I don't
what?
Know.
No.
You have already forgotten that across the three shows that we have filmed and are available on digital download, this song is not on them. We
that was from
never
Psy
released
Curious.
It.
We didn't film that.
Yeah, we never released it. I really miss it. I really feel like it contributes something to the beauty of the world that is available to us. And also... It heralded the invention of the Pythagoras cream, which was a genuine biscuit. Yeah. We pretended that it was a real biscuit. Matt, like, pretended to design it on the overhead projector at the end of the song.
Pretty
and at one of our tour shows, I think it was in the Midlands somewhere.
Derby.
One of our now lovely friends, Wendy, who didn't really know at the time, turned up at one of our shows having baked a Pythagoras cream. So not only is this song, when performed live, a contribution to the general levels of funny, clever, and beautiful, it is also like a culinary pinnacle for the future.
So that's the end of the episode. Another skirmish in the battle for hearts and minds.
As always, we've got show notes. And as always, we are part of the Acast Creator Network.
Yes, both those things, full of extra details. The show notes specifically have links to the amicable number keyrings, a free download of the uncorrected version of Helen's song, which, I don't know why you want that, and possibly some extremely rare footage of Steve blushing, if we can capture that in the wild.
Can your epidermis even lift, Steve?
I don't think it can, no.
We would love you to review us on iTunes if you get a spare moment. It really does make a difference to how many people get to hear about the podcast. Or just let us know what you think on social media, or maybe send us a nice email or something. podcast@festivalofthespokennerd.com.
If this podcast has given you an appetite for more free stuff, all of our YouTube channels are linked from our website. And for the price of just £5, you can download any of our comedy specials where we do science and maths live on stage. You can get all of that at festivalofthespokennerd.com.
Thanks for coming. Bye.
Bye.
See ya. Bye. See ya. A podcast of Unnecessary Detail is made by Festival of the Spoken Nerd. That's Helen Arney, Steve Mould, and Matt Parker. Our series producer is Lindsay Fenner, who also produced this episode. Our theme music is by Howard Carter, and we are proud to be part of the Acast Creator Network. Thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.